Chapter 6 The Consultant 1. 3 years earlier, when Mercer returned to Camino Island for the first time in many years, she did so under the pretense of taking a sabbatical to finish a novel. She settled into the cottage built by her grandmother Tessa, which was still owned by the family. She hung around the bookstore, met Lee and Myra, Bob Cobb, Andy Adam, and the rest of the gang, and quickly ingratiated herself with the island's literary mafia, of which Bruce was the unquestioned leader. She made little progress with the novel, though she claimed otherwise. The writing was part of the act, the ruse, the smokescreen to divert attention away from her real motive. She was being paid a handsome sum by a mysterious security firm hired by an insurance company that was desperately searching for some stolen manuscripts. A lot of money was on the line, especially for the insurance company, and the security firm had come to believe that one Bruce Cable had the manuscripts hidden somewhere on the island. And they were correct. What the firm didn't know was that Bruce was suspicious of Mercer from day one. And as she got closer and closer, and indeed all the way to his bedroom, he became even more convinced that she was working for the enemy. Her presence prompted him to ship the manuscripts overseas and eventually sell them for a fortune in ransom. Though the elaborate ruse had failed, in the end, all parties were happy, especially Bruce. The owner, Princeton's library, got the priceless manuscripts back. The insurance company took a hit, but the damage could have been far worse. Of the actual thieves, little need be said. Three were in prison, one was dead. Since then, Bruce had marveled at the security firm's elaborate scheme. It was nothing short of brilliant and had almost worked. He became convinced that he needed to know more about the people who had almost ruined him. He leaned on Mercer, who reluctantly made the phone call and established the contact. Her handler had been a shrewd operator named Elaine Shelby, and Bruce was determined to meet her. 2. The building was one of half a dozen tall, new, gleaming structures near Dulles Airport, 24 miles west of the U.S. Capitol and in the sprawl of Northern Virginia. From the moment Bruce parked his rental car underground, he felt as though he was being monitored. At the front desk, he was photographed, body scanned, and asked to stare into a camera to record forever his facial features. As he was led to an elevator, he searched in vain for a directory on a wall, but didn't see one. Evidently, the folks who leased these offices did not favor publicity. A security guard was waiting when he stepped off on the fourth floor. No smile, no pleasant greeting, no meaningful word. Just a grunt and a motion. There were no work pods with multiple desks, no pools of secretaries. From the time Bruce stepped off the elevator until he walked into the office of Elaine Shelby, he saw no one else except the guard. Elaine was coming around her desk with a smile and handshake as the guard closed the door. "I feel as though you should frisk me," Bruce said. "Bend over," she snapped, and Bruce burst out laughing. She waved to a sofa and said, "Might as well laugh, Cable. You beat us fair and square." They took seats around a low table, and she began pouring coffee. "You got the manuscripts back," he said. "Everybody's happy. Easy for you to say." "It was a brilliant idea, Miss Shelby. Drop the formal stuff. I'll be Elaine, and you'll be Bruce, okay?" "Fine with me." "You call it brilliant. In our business, we call it a failure, which I hate to say is not that unusual. We are dealt the toughest cases, and we don't always win."
"But you always get paid."
"Damn right we do. Don't you just love Mercer?"
"I tried my best. Great girl. Wonderful writer."
"Did you guys make it all the way to bed?"
"Oh, I never kiss and tell, Elaine. That's very unprofessional."
"You have a horrible reputation for chasing the young female writers."
Why is that horrible? I assure you it's all consensual. These liberated women are on the road and looking for fun. I just try to accommodate them. We know, that was our plan. Almost brilliant. Was it your idea? We have teams. No one works solo around here. It was a joint effort. Okay, what can you tell me about this outfit? I understand you want to hire us. I'm interested, but I need to know more. She took a sip of coffee and recrossed her legs. Bruce refused to notice. Well, for lack of a better description, we are a security firm. Do you have a name? Not really. So if I eventually write out a check for payment, it will be pay to the order of Alpha North Solutions. How wonderfully bland. And you came up with Bay Books? I did. Much sexier. Is it really that important for you to like our name? I guess not. May I proceed? You did inquire. I did. Please, sorry. Anyway, we provide security for companies and individuals. We investigate crimes for insurance companies and other clients. We subcontract with the federal government to consult on security matters. We operate around the world with headquarters here. Why here? Why does it matter? It doesn't, I guess. It's just that you're stuck out here in the middle of nowhere with nothing but 8-lane roads running in all directions. It's convenient. Dulles is right there, and we travel a lot. Virtually every employee here is former FBI or CIA, and this area is home. And you? FBI for 15 years. Worked primarily in recovering stolen art and manuscripts, among other items. I've looked through the materials you sent. Interesting reading. And you're smart to avoid email. I assume the locals down there have not made much progress. Not much at all, I'm afraid. And you realize this will be expensive? Yep. I wouldn't be here if I were looking for a bargain. Okay. So I suggest that we walk down the hall to visit my colleague, Lindsay Wheat, one of our homicide investigators, and until 5 years ago, one of the FBI's finest. She was also one of the first female African-American agents in the field. Why would she, or you, leave the Bureau? Money and politics. The pay here is about 4 times that of the Bureau, and most of us are women who got sick of the internal politics and sexism. She stood and motioned toward the door. Bruce followed her down the empty hall. Ms. Wheat was at her desk and rose with a big smile when they walked in. Last names were discarded as first names were assumed. She was about 50 and as slender and stylish as Elaine. She walked them over to a similar sitting area and inquired about coffee. All declined. Bruce had already gone through one round of preliminary chit-chat and wished to avoid another. He said, "So you specialize in old murders?" Lindsay smiled and said, "Or recent ones. It doesn't matter. I began on the streets as a homicide detective. Houston, Seattle, 5 years in Tampa. It's a thick resume if you'd like to take a look." "Maybe later." Bruce had already accepted the fact that these people were eminently qualified. For a second, it made him even prouder that he had outfoxed them 3 years earlier. Lindsay asked, "Have you talked to the FBI down there? If it's a contract for hire, then it's likely to be federal." "That's what I've been told. But no, I have not talked to the FBI. Not sure how one does that, really. I'm just a simple bookseller who knows little about the law." He smiled at Elaine, who rolled her eyes. "So you've read the materials, too?" he asked Lindsay.
"Yes."
"Look, before we wade in too deep, I'd like to clear the air about your fees. I know this won't be cheap, and we, Nelson's sister, who is his executrix, and me, are willing to step up. But we have limits. Nelson was my friend and he deserves justice, but I'm only willing to pay for so much of it. His sister feels the same way." What's in the estate? Elaine asked. It's complicated. About 2 million cash in assets, no debts. But he buried some money offshore years ago and kept it away from his ex-wife. It's in the common stock of a company and worth around 8 million, for a total of 10. The state and federal exemptions this year are 11 million and change, so the estate is free and clear. The ex-wife is lawyered up and is deeply wounded because she got the shaft several marriages ago. But Nelson's sister thinks her feelings can be soothed with a couple of million. Bottom line, the estate is in good shape and is willing to write a check. The obvious question is, how much will this cost before it's all over?
We don't guarantee a win in this business, Elaine said.
I understand. It's a long shot.
$300,000, Lindsay said. From soup to nuts, all up front. No hourly billing, no monthly statements, expenses included.
Bruce nodded and stared at her pretty eyes without blinking. Polly had predicted $500,000, but then she was in California. Bruce was hoping for $200,000 or so and refused to flinch at $300,000. He would pay half, as would the estate. He could afford it, and Ms. Shelby, sitting across from him with a smirk, damned well knew it. What she didn't know was where his ransom was buried. He shrugged as if it grew on trees and said, "Deal. Now what do we get for the money?"
"Hopefully the killer," Lindsay said with a smile.
3. Elaine shook Bruce's hand goodbye and left them to their business. Bruce followed Lindsay down the hall to a larger room with screens on all four walls and a long table filled with laptops and other devices. They sat across the table from each other, and she opened a file of some sort.
"Let's start with the woman," she said as she pushed a button on something and Ingrid's computer-generated face appeared on two of the wide screens. Lindsay said, "Of course, we don't know this woman, nor anyone who might be her. But we'll begin the search."
"The search for what?"
"A contract killer. We know of several, but it's a fairly nebulous group. They don't convene annually for parties, and they don't have a registry."
"You know the names of contract killers?"
"Of course. The FBI has monitored them for years. Back in the old days, most were mafia boys who killed each other in turf battles. But today, there are a few who are known."
"How? How do you know about them?"
"Mainly through informants, snitches, rats. Almost all contract killings are done by dumb criminals who need a few bucks to knock off a spouse or hubby's secret girlfriend. Family stuff, usually. Bad business deals are not uncommon. Most of the hitmen are caught and convicted by forensics."
"Where might one find a good hitman?"
"Well, you can actually start online, believe it or not. But those guys cannot be trusted."
"Imagine that, a dishonest hitman."
"Right. If you wanted to knock off, say, a business partner, you'd probably start with a local private investigator, someone you might know and trust. He'll know someone who's done hard time and lives around the fringes. He might also know an ex-cop, or maybe a former Army Ranger, someone accomplished with weapons. Guns are used 9 times out of 10. About 60% of the time, word leaks out. The police get a tip, and everybody gets arrested before there's a killing."
"But we're not dealing with a dumb criminal here," Bruce said, enjoying the discussion.
"No, we are not. There are a few contract killers who are referred to in the trade as masters. They rarely get caught, and they are well paid."
"How much?" She pressed a button, and Ingrid disappeared. 6 names were listed in one column. Beside each was the year of death, and to the far right was an amount of money. The largest sum was $2.5 million, the lowest, $500,000. Lindsay said,
"None of these figures can be trusted, but 10 years ago, a retired hitman wrote a long tell-all piece for an online crime magazine, anonymous, of course. He claimed responsibility for the first 3 murders. His command of the details convinced the FBI he was there.
The last two are from other sources. Why did he retire? Bruce asked.
He turned 65. Social Security kicked in, or so he said. Had a real sense of humor. He wrote that he almost got caught during his last job when things got messy. A young teenage boy got in the way and took a bullet. The hitman found a conscience and hung up his Glock.
And none of these five killings were ever solved?
No. The cases are still open.
So our little venture is indeed a long shot.
Absolutely. I thought we were clear, no?
Yes, quite clear. Bruce kept staring at the numbers. The pay's not bad, he said.
The average job is about $10,000, but as I said, the average hitman is not that bright. Most get caught because somebody talks too much, and most of the people handing over the cash aren't that smart either. You're going through a nasty divorce, and your spouse is suddenly murdered? Don't you think the police might have some questions?
I don't recognize any of the victims.
None are from Florida, and none involve divorces. Most were bad business deals. The last one was an inheritance issue.
Do you have photos or composite sketches of other contract killers? She punched some keys, and another computerized face flashed on the screen. Male, age 40. Caucasian, flat nose, beady eyes, bushy hair, and so on. It was only a sketch. She said,
4 years ago, this guy was seen leaving a marina in Galveston just seconds before a yacht burst into flames. Three people died, not from burns, but from bullets to the head. Probably a bad business deal.
And a bad sketch. This guy could be one of a million.
Yes, but it's not one of our cases, luckily.
May I ask how you got the sketch?
We have a lot of contacts, some within law enforcement, some on the outside.
Nice to know. So our girl is a master killer. Lindsay hit a key and Ingrid returned to the screens.
Not so sure about that. She allowed herself to be seen by a number of people. She slept with your friend several times. They had lunch and dinner out, and so on. That's highly unusual for a killer at the master level. Normally, these guys are never seen, but on the other hand, hiding in plain view is often a smart move.
Maybe she had no choice. Sleeping with Bob led her to her target.
Any chance she slept with Nelson?
Who knows? He was single and close by. A nice-looking gal, great body, ready to hop in the sack for other reasons, but eager nonetheless. Surely you've seen this before.
Not really. It's not unusual in the world of espionage, but we've never seen it. The elite spy services have always recruited beautiful women who know how to seduce. As you know, men can be quite weak at times.
So I've heard. But this is not exactly the Mossad, right?
Highly unlikely. A trained spy would not run the risk of being caught on video around the hotel.
How many contract killers are female?
Zero, in my experience. Ingrid would be the first.
So, how'd she do it?
I've read your summary, and I think you're pretty close. She arrived on the island with a colleague, probably a man, posing as a couple. They leased a condo near Nelson's. I assume there are plenty available.
Only about a million. It is Florida.
She hooked up with your friend Bob, and that's how she met Nelson. She got lucky when the storm appeared, and that virtually eliminated her chances of being caught. She's gone.
No chance of finding her.
Always a slight chance. I'll meet with my pals at the FBI and have a chat. They'll be excited to see Ingrid here, to add her to their rather short list of professional killers. Who knows? This is a murky world. And there's often a potential informant looking for money. It's a long shot, but there might be someone out there who knows a thing or two and needs a buck. Doubtful, though.
What's your theory on his computer?
After she killed him, she would not have left without his hard drive. However, if she simply stole it, then she would have left behind a massive clue for the police.
She replaced it?
That's my guess. replaced it with a hard drive that contains nothing useful but is heavily encrypted. The police can't scratch its surface.
So she knew the specs of his desktop.
Again, we're guessing at this point, but my answer would be yes. She and her pal had probably been inside Nelson's condo. Did he have home security?
Yes, there was an alarm system. There was a camera at the front door and another looking at the rear patio. Both were destroyed in the storm. The police think they may have been disabled beforehand.
Where is his computer? She asked.
Police? They're supposed to hand it over, along with other personal effects, next week. Polly McCann will meet with them and take possession. I've been pushed out of the investigation, which is fine with me.
What day next week?
Wednesday.
I'd like to be there.
Come on down. I'll give you the grand tour.
We really need to look at the hard drive. If it's a dummy left behind by the killer, that's a clue, though I'm not sure what we can do with it. If it's the real hard drive, then it could be a treasure trove of information.
Assuming it can be accessed.
Yes. But didn't you say in your notes that his sister has the passcode for the thumb drive?
She does.
Lindsay flashed a knowing smile and said, "That's all we need. Our guys can get in with that."
I'm drowning here. This is way over my head.
Mine too. We'll let the experts worry about it.
So you'll need the thumb drive?
Of course. I want to read the novel, and we'll use it to try to penetrate Nelson's hard drive.
I'll bet you don't find much. He was secretive and didn't trust the internet, hated the cloud, refused to shop online, said nothing important in emails, ignored all social media, paid cash for most of his purchases. I doubt if Nelson left too many footprints behind.
And the condo is on the market?
Oh, yes. It's been scrubbed, painted, emptied, as good as new. The police released it 3 weeks ago. The market is very soft, though.
And you can arrange a meeting with Polly McCann?
I'd be delighted. I have nothing else to do. No one's buying books on the island, and I'm bored to death.
4. The middle-aged man had the jaded and shaggy look of a veteran reporter. He stopped by the bookstore, found Bruce bored at his desk, and helped himself to a chair. He said he was a freelancer for Newsweek and tossed over a card that was supposed to verify this. Bruce examined the card. Donald Uster, Washington address. Uster was sniffing around, trying to put together a story about the death of best-selling author Nelson Kerr. He had done the legwork that one would expect. He had examined the file in probate court, but found little. The inventory of assets and liabilities wasn't due for several months. He had pestered Carl Logan, Santa Rosa's police chief, but got nowhere. He had made contact with Captain Wes Butler of the state police, but was told that there was nothing to discuss because it was an ongoing investigation.
"Aren't all homicide investigations ongoing until they find the killer?" Uster asked with a laugh.
Bruce talked cautiously about Nelson and his time on the island, and his books, but he was careful not to say anything about the crime scene or anything else. Several days after Nelson died, there were brief stories in a few newspapers about his death during the hurricane. An online publishing magazine mentioned the police involvement, but revealed nothing. The Jacksonville Daily ran a short obituary, then followed it with a slightly longer article about the investigation. Before Uster, no reporter had contacted Bruce.
"Was he working on a novel?" Uster asked. "Don't know about that," Bruce replied, "but most writers are usually working on something. I chatted with his ex-editor at Simon & Schuster. Guy said Kerr was jumping ship, looking for a new house and working on something big."
"I believe he was still looking. To my knowledge, Nelson was not under contract when he died. He was also between agents."
"How much do you know about his past, his old days as a lawyer?"
"How much do you know?"
Uster laughed again nervously. "I tracked down a former colleague out there, but the guy said it was 10 years ago. Not much, really. I tried his ex-wife, a tough one."
"Never met her. Is it fair to call him a best-selling author? I mean, I know that gets thrown around all the time, but did he really sell that many books?
He did. All three of his novels hit the lists, The Times and Publishers Weekly, and each book did better than the last. I encouraged him to write more, but he enjoyed travel, sport fishing, life on the beach.
100,000 copies each time out?
I'd guess. You can find his numbers online.
I've looked, and I've been told those numbers are not that accurate. Did you sell his books?
I did. Nelson had a following.
You think he was murdered?
I'm not saying anything that you might want to print. The state police are investigating. That's all I can say.
Fair enough. Do you know his sister, Polly McCann?
I do.
Would you ask her to talk to me? She's hung up twice.
No, sorry. Don't know her that well.
Ooster jumped to his feet and headed for the door. I'll be back. Give me a call if you hear something.
Don't bet on it.
Sure.
5. The boredom ran on unabated as the days finally cooled. The week after his trip to D.C., Bruce welcomed Lindsay Wheat and Polly McCann to Bay Books. They met in his newly renovated office on the first floor, in his first editions room, the walls lined with hundreds of autographed books. It was a Saturday morning, and for a change, the store was busy as young mothers brought in their children for story time upstairs in the cafe. Normally, Bruce would have been up there among them, sipping cappuccino and flirting with the ladies. But he had important business at hand. The day before, Polly had met with Wesley Butler at the crime lab and received yet another useless update. Little progress had been made. Indeed, so little that she could not remember anything new. Butler did hand over Nelson's laptop, desktop, cell phone, and 2 leather briefcases. He admitted that their tech people had been unable to penetrate the encryption codes Nelson had used. Again, he did not have the presence of mind to ask Polly if she knew anything about her brother's novel in progress. He gave every indication that he wasn't sure what to do next and was generally not that concerned with solving the crime. And he made a point of letting her know that he did not want Bruce Cable calling again and sticking his nose into the investigation. Bruce took this news well. As far as he was concerned, the state police were not a factor, and he had already wasted too much time with them. Lindsay took the thumb drive from Polly, plugged it into her laptop, entered its encryption passcode, and sent its data to her technicians at the home office. She gave it to Bruce and asked him to print 3 hard copies of the manuscript for their evening's reading. They were in agreement that it was time to read Nelson's last masterpiece. The 10-page treatment written by Thomas and Mercer had been useful, but the full story was now needed. An hour later, Lindsay received a phone call from her office with decoding instructions. She opened the desktop, entered the codes, and to no one's surprise, found the 2 hard drives secured by another layer of encryption. As she expected, Ingrid had stolen the 2 real ones at about the same time she murdered Nelson and had replaced them. She and her gang had no way of knowing that Polly had a thumb drive with a passcode and the finished novel. They rightfully assumed the police would be unable to log into Nelson's computer and the search would end there. As for his laptop, there were no passcodes and all access was blocked. Lindsay agreed to take it back to the office and let the techies have a go, but she was not optimistic. They spent 2 hours with endless cups of black coffee plowing through Nelson's notebooks and random files. At lunchtime, Bruce ordered takeout, and they continued working in his office. A clerk delivered sandwiches and iced tea, and as she left, Bruce asked if she had seen any customers that morning.
"Only the kids," she said with a laugh.
Lindsay, the professional, and the one being paid by the other 2, had gently assumed control of the conversations. Bruce and Polly were happy to trust her and follow along. As they ate, she said,
I have an idea for a plan that we have discussed back home at the office. We can agree that Nelson showed no interest in nursing homes at any point in his life until the end. So someone approached him. Someone with the story. Someone on the inside. An informant. A whistleblower. Though whispering to an author is not exactly blowing the whistle the way the FBI sees things. But you get the picture. This person chose not to go to the police for whatever reason, so he found Nelson. He read his books and knew that he wasn't shy about using his fiction to expose some nasty people and their businesses. All names changed to protect the guilty, of course. This person is crucial to our success. Bruce was nodding along as he ate his sandwich. He had heard this before. Nick Sutton had predicted months ago that an informant was involved. Lindsay continued, "We have to make it easier for this person to come find us. This person is probably watching the probate file. It's all public and online and looking for a way to contact us. Step one of the plan is to appoint Bruce as the executor of Nelson's literary estate. Step two is to sell the novel to a publisher and make sure it's reported. Bruce, this is your territory, and you'll do a better job at it than Polly can do out in California." Bruce said, "I'm not sure I want Ingrid back on the island." "You can forget her. She's gone." Polly said, "We discussed this months ago. Remember, Bruce, I asked you to handle his literary affairs."
"Yes, of course I remember. Do you remember why I said no?"
"No. Things were a blur back then."
"It makes perfect sense," Lindsay said. "You know the agents and publishers, and you can get a good deal for the book. Plus, you're more knowledgeable about the backlist and what to do with it."
"The backlist?"
Polly asked. "His old titles, all in paperback," Bruce replied.
"Will they still earn royalties?"
Polly asked. "Oh, yes. Especially with a new book out. The estate will earn royalties for a few more years. Then they'll trickle away, I guess."
"What about film interest?"
Lindsay asked. "Nelson's had that in the past, though nothing happened. Almost every bestseller gets its share of attention from film and television. But I'm not sure I want the attention from the bad guys. We're laboring here under the assumption that Nelson was killed for a reason, right? If I'm the one pushing his books, you might find me with a gash or two in the skull." Lindsay waved him off.
"They're done, and they're not coming back. No way they'll risk another job like this. It was a pretty stupid move in the first place. They wanted to stop Nelson from publishing the book, but they didn't know that he had finished it. Now it will be published anyway."
Polly said,
"We're assuming it's good enough to publish, right?"
"Right," Bruce replied.
"I've told you this, Bruce. I can't read his stuff. I've tried many times and it just doesn't appeal to me. I can't imagine having to deal with his literary estate for years to come. I'm out of my league with the rest of his estate. I really want you to take the job."
"Okay, that's one reason," Bruce said. "But the other reason is to attract this informant person who we think might actually exist, but we're not sure."
"Correct," said Lindsay. "We think it could be a crucial part of our plan."
"And who's we?"
"My people, Bruce. My team. This is what we do, what you're paying for. We lay the traps, create the fiction, put the right people in place, and hope it all works. Just like 3 years ago, you said yourself our plan was brilliant."
"It was, but it didn't work."
"What happened 3 years ago?" Polly asked.
Bruce smiled and said, "Let's save it for dinner." A clerk walked in with three bulky manuscripts, all 4 inches thick. He dropped them on Bruce's desk, handed him the thumb drive, and left the room. Lindsay said,
"Well, I guess we have our work in front of us."
Polly said,
"I really don't want to read that. The summary was tedious enough."
Bruce said, "I'm afraid you have no choice." You're both welcome to retire to my home and read on the porch, the veranda, in a hammock, or wherever. Noelle is there, and she would enjoy having you around.
Where are you going to read? Polly asked.
Right here. I'm fast, and I need to keep an eye on the store, just in case a lost customer stumbles in.
6. Early reviews for Pulse were mixed. When they gathered for cocktails at dark on the veranda, the three weary readers compared notes. Bruce claimed to be almost finished, though he admitted he often skimmed as he blitzed through books. He was enjoying the story, said he was hooked. Lindsay professed to be no literary critic, and her taste ran to nonfiction and biography. But she was enjoying the story. The writing wasn't that great. Polly was hardly halfway through the pile of 500 typewritten pages and seriously doubted if she could finish.
"Can you sell it?" she asked.
"Of course," Bruce replied. "Given Nelson's track record, some publisher somewhere will give us a contract. It's very commercial, and the pages turn." Bruce did not miss Polly's use of the word "you," as if the probate court had already substituted him as Nelson's literary executor. He waited for her to ask, "How much?" But she did not. Noelle appeared with a bottle of white wine and refilled the glasses. She was certainly welcome to sit and join the conversation. Bruce had made it clear that he told her everything, but she left to check on dinner. Bruce said, "I keep asking myself, as I read, how much of this can really be true? Is there really a drug that can prolong life in the sickest of old people? A drug whose true side effects are really unknown because the patients are comatose and dying anyway?" Lindsay said, "It's bizarre, but right now we have to assume it's real. Nelson was murdered for a reason, and until we know otherwise, we are assuming it's because of this novel."
"Which makes the informant all the more plausible," Polly said, "because there was no way Nelson knew anything about this story. I've been on the internet for 2 months and have found nothing even remotely similar to this scenario."
"Same here," Lindsay said. "If it's true, it's a deeply guarded secret."
"With billions on the line," Bruce said.
"So let's speculate," Polly said. "You're Nelson Kerr, and you've written 3 bestsellers, none dealing with drugs, healthcare, the like. You're approached by an informant, probably someone working for the drug maker or the nursing homes, and this informant wants to talk. He wants to expose the bad guys."
Bruce said, "And he also wants some money. He's sticking his neck out, and he wants to be compensated."
"Why not just go to the FBI?
Polly asked.
"Because he's not sure it's a crime," Lindsay said. "The drug is prolonging lives, not killing people." "But it's fraud, right?"
"Don't know. It's never been litigated, never been heard of. The informant isn't sure he'll get anything for blowing the whistle. He has a conscience. He's frightened. He needs his job. So he decides to approach Nelson Kerr, an author he admires."
Bruce said, "And Nelson started digging and asked too many questions. The bad guys realized they might have a problem, and they were probably watching him. When they realized what he was doing, they panicked and decided to take him out."
"A really stupid move," Lindsay said. "Think about it. It has already been reported that he died under suspicious circumstances during a hurricane. He had just finished a novel, his last one, and it's about to be published. Can you imagine the media frenzy when word leaks that the author was murdered? If you're the guy who ordered the hit, publicity is the last thing you want. There will be more people digging into the murder while the book is flying off the shelves. A really stupid move by someone."
"Agreed. But who?" Polly asked.
"We'll find out," Lindsay said.
"I'd like to hear your plan," Bruce said.
"We are paying for it," Polly added.
Lindsay relaxed in her chair and kicked off her sandals. She took a sip of wine and seemed to savor it. Noelle appeared in the doorway and said dinner would be ready in 5 minutes if anyone wanted to wash up.
Lindsay finally said, "Initially, we're moving on two fronts. The first one we've discussed, and it calls for Bruce to become the literary executor, sell the book, and generate as much buzz as possible over the author's death. We hope that this will attract Nelson's informant. The second front involves the infiltration of the industry. There are 8 companies that control 95% of all nursing home beds. 6 are publicly traded, and because they answer to shareholders, they generally comply with regulations and stay out of trouble. The other 2 are privately owned, and both are bad actors. They get sued all the time and are notorious for health violations, shoddy record-keeping, pathetic facilities. It's a long, sad list. You wouldn't want anyone you know staying in one of their homes. Both are billion-dollar corporations. So we go in." Bruce and Polly were left hanging and waited for more. Finally, Bruce said, "You use the word infiltrate."
"Yes. We have methods. We're not the government, Bruce, and as you know, we have ways of gathering information that some might consider in the gray areas. We never break laws, but we're also not bound by such legal niceties as probable cause and valid warrants."
Polly said,
"Excuse me, but what are we talking about?"
"I'll explain it over dinner," Bruce said. "But you're working for us, Lindsay, and it's fair for us to ask if you operate outside the law."
"No, we know the gray areas. As do you, Bruce."
7. Noelle was an excellent cook, and her lobster ravioli was well received. The conversation was about flood insurance, or lack thereof, and how many people on the island were realizing that their losses were not covered. As with all storms, the early responders and aid groups were crucial and much appreciated. But with time, they had moved on to the next disaster. Bruce filled his wine glass and shoved his plate a few inches away. "So, Polly, I don't know if you recall, but 3 or 4 years ago, some valuable manuscripts were stolen from the Firestone Library at Princeton. Though they were considered priceless, they were insured for $25 million. Princeton didn't want the money. It wanted the manuscripts. The insurance company didn't want to write a check, so it decided to track down the manuscripts. It hired Lindsay's firm." Lindsay smiled and went along like a good sport. "At the time, I was a pretty serious dealer in the rare book trade, a dark and murky world on the best of days. And I was even suspected at times of handling stolen rare books. Don't ask if I did that, because I will not answer. And if I do answer, I have been known to dabble in fiction, like my favorite writers." Noelle said,
"I'm not sure you should tell this story, Bruce."
"I will not tell everything. So in the course of events, some people came to suspect me of having possession of the Princeton manuscripts. Again, don't ask. A very talented operative working for Lindsay's firm set up this elaborate plan to infiltrate my home, business, and circle of friends. The plan was to get really close to me and snoop. They zeroed in on Mercer Mann and offered her enough money. She was broke and a good target. She also had a history with the island. Mercer showed up at her grandmother's cottage on the beach, said she would be here for 6 months to finish her novel. It was a great story, a great cover, and it worked perfectly, until it didn't. She became a delightful friend of ours, and she sat at this table many times. We adored Mercer, still do. A writer with enormous talent."
"Did she find the manuscripts?" Polly asked.
"No. But she got close enough to send in the FBI. They were a bit late, barely. Some money changed hands, and the manuscripts eventually made it back to Princeton. In the end, everybody was happy."
"And that's enough of that story," Noelle said.
"Indeed it is."
"Am I supposed to be impressed or comforted?" Polly asked.
"Impressed," Bruce said. Lindsay's firm is not cheap, and it's worth the money we're paying.
8. Jean-Luc finally died the week before Thanksgiving. Noelle seemed to take it well, though Bruce left her alone. If she was grieving, he certainly didn't want to know about it. She was subdued for several days, but put on her game face and did not mention her longtime boyfriend. Bruce had some business in New York and left the island for a week. The more he left home, the more he thought about escaping. The island was frazzled and his neighbors were weary. Leo hit 3.5 months earlier, and with time it was becoming apparent that the recovery would take years. It was there every day, staring you in the face. A stretch of fence to mend or replace, an old tree with debris still stuck in the limbs, a leaky roof that no contractor had time to fix, an abandoned house too damaged to repair, a drainage ditch choked with garbage, a city park filled with FEMA trailers and desperate people sitting in lawn chairs around them, waiting for something. In the woods nearby, people even more desperate still, living in tents. For a spell, Bruce considered closing the store, taking a year off, running away to some exotic place with Noelle, and doing nothing but reading all the great books he had neglected. He had no debts, plenty of money in the bank. He could call it a sabbatical or whatever and reopen it sometime in the future when the island was whole again and the tourists were back. But the moment passed. Bay Books was too important to the island, and Bruce could not imagine life without it. That plus he was loyal to his employees and customers. The Christmas season was at hand, and 1/3 of all book sales took place during the holidays. He and his staff decided to decorate the store even more than usual and keep longer hours and offer more discounts and giveaways and throw some parties. The island needed its bookstore to hold things together and remind everyone that life was returning to normal. Bruce spent most of December at his desk reworking Pulse. He had always enjoyed editing the works of other writers, and he read so many popular novels that he could always tweak here and there and improve them. For the first and perhaps only time in his life, he now had the chance to fiddle with an entire manuscript. Bruce paid a typist to produce a clean draft, and when it was finished, he coerced Bob Cobb into reading it. Bob was not that impressed with the writing or the story, but then he was often too critical of other writers. Nick was home from Venice, and Bruce shipped him a hard copy in Nashville. He read it in 2 days and said it would sell. The first week in January, Bruce went to court with the probate lawyer and got himself appointed as the executor of Nelson's literary estate. The old judge had never heard of such a position, but was happy to sign the order nonetheless. The following day, he sent the book to Nelson's former editor at Simon & Schuster. They had been discussing it for a month, and its arrival was no surprise. Nelson had become unhappy with the editor for some vague reason that no longer mattered. Bruce, on behalf of the estate, was not looking for a fat contract. The book did not deserve one, and no publisher would be willing to overpay a dead writer who couldn't promote the book, let alone follow it with a sequel. And money was not an issue. Nelson's estate would eventually be a windfall to Polly and her parents, and they were not greedy people. Left unsaid was the fact that Bruce didn't want a big contract. More money meant more publicity, especially when the word murder got tossed around, and Bruce was not looking forward to the attention. Ingrid was out there somewhere, and if not her, then probably someone else. Lindsay Wheat was adamant in her belief that those responsible for Nelson's murder were not that smart and would not strike again. But then she worked in the shadows, and few knew her name. Mr. Cable had been appointed by the court with all the details available online. A week later,
The editor called and offered $250,000 for all rights, hardback, ebook, paperback, and foreign. The money was about half what the book was worth. And had Bruce been a tough literary agent, he would have stormed off and threatened an auction. But he was not. And since he was earning nothing from the transaction, he pondered it for a day, pushed for $300,000, and got it. In fact, the contract was perfect. It was generous enough to be fair to the estate, but low enough not to raise eyebrows. Bruce emailed the editor a press release he had worked on for hours. It read, "The last novel of popular suspense writer Nelson Kerr has been purchased by Simon & Schuster, his longtime publisher. The novel Pulse will be released next year with an anticipated first run of 100,000 copies. Mr. Kerr's three previous novels, Swan City, The Laundry, and Hard Water, were all published by Simon & Schuster and became bestsellers. His editor, Tom Dowdy, said, "We are delighted to receive Nelson's latest, though we are still devastated by his death. He talked about this novel for years, and we are certain his many fans will enjoy it." Mr. Kerr was a resident of Camino Island, Florida, and died under mysterious circumstances last August during Hurricane Leo. His death is still being investigated by the Florida State Police. His friend and bookstore owner, Bruce Cable, has been appointed as his literary executor and handled the sale to Simon & Schuster. Mr. Cable was not available for comment. The estate is offering a sizable reward for information regarding Mr. Kerr's death.